Our next guest on the program has had a long career as an actor, writer, producer, and in all that time has also been doing very wonderful work all over the world as an activist. Always a treat for us to talk to him on the program as we welcome Mike Farrell back to the show. Mike, good afternoon.
How are you doing, Rich?
I'm doing very well, thanks. How have you been since last we talked?
A little upside down since last we talked. Things have gone in a different, an odd sort of direction from my perspective here in the country. So I'm trying to adjust, trying to figure out how to best to respond.
Well, I think we're all in that boat, and you know, frankly, even people who were on the side that emerged victorious are wondering what the path ahead looks like for us. And so, I wanted to ask you if, given the uncertain times we're in, if activism is now perhaps more important than ever.
Oh, I absolutely. In my view, it's always important for, you know, I think you and I have discussed this in the past. I shudder just a bit at the term activist, only because for too many people it connotes a kind of wild-haired individual who's out there screaming epithets at people. And I think that we as citizens, according to Thomas Jefferson, really have to be informed and involved. And so I think citizen activism is urgently necessary at all times, but even more urgently necessary today.
Well, Mike, when people have given you credit, and many have through the years, they've quite often talked about the fact that you've been able to go into a room full of people who may well disagree with you and do so in a civil, respectful manner. And so, boy, in these times, that seems very important. What are some guidelines? What are some things all of us can do to have those conversations with people and keep them civil and honest and open?
Well, I think respect is the primary thing. You know, if you believe in human rights, as I do, the rights of all individuals to have a life that is consistent with their potential and their intelligence and their health and their standing. But I think we have to understand that some people, on different issues, there are people who will disagree, have a different perspective, and that's fine. I mean, the American way is that we work those differences out to a point of compromise, and sometimes agree completely, other times agree in part, but learn to live together. But it involves mutual respect. And my concern, what I'm seeing today, is that there is a kind of division that is absent respect. Respect for tradition, respect for law, respect for the other people involved. And that really creates an almost unbridgeable gap, and that's very worrisome to me.
Has the proliferation of media, and not even to mention social media, made it more difficult to have those civil, respectful conversations?
I think that's quite right. I think that social media in particular has given everybody the opportunity to sound off, if you will, and in some cases people use it quite responsibly. In other cases, I think people are pretty thoughtless about the way they use their social media. But everything seems to have the same weight, if you will. And so if you have someone who, for whatever reason, wants to put up a message conveying so-called facts that are really not facts, it can really confuse the people who are on the receiving end, but also confuse the dialogue. If one knows for certain that some things are this way, and the other person says no, they're not, then it becomes, you know, the ground we stand on is in question, and that doesn't make, it seems to me, for mutually respectful conversation.
We're talking with Mike Farrell here on Downtown. Mike, regardless of the results of the election, in your conversations with people around the country, in your travels, has the tenor of the country changed? Because it seemed like over the course of the last 8 years, we were making progress as a nation at giving more people the rights that they deserve and being more open and accepting and understanding. Has that somehow miraculously changed?
No, I don't think it's changed. Well, in part, yes, it has changed. Forgive me for giving away. I was trying to avoid being partisan, but in the event that someone in a position of authority gives permission through her or his behavior and words to the worst among us, to the worst inclinations, I should say, in us, that creates a real problem. And that's, I think, what has happened, is we find ourselves in a place where the most, you know, the Lincoln talked about the better angels of our nature. Mm. If we have those better angels, and I believe we do, then what is the contrary force? And if the contrary force is a negative, disrespectful, even judgmental and hate-filled tendency, and if that is given support by people in authority, it creates havoc.
Is there a danger in our governmental policies? And obviously everybody wants the country to be safe, but is there a danger in some of the things that we do, and perhaps it's already happened to a certain degree, that we as a country lose the moral high ground?
I think that's what's happening today, frankly. When you know, President Donald Trump is president. He has been elected by the, not the majority of the people, but by the process as it has been established. And his rhetoric has been quite dismissive of whole peoples and people of a certain faith. And it's been careless, in my view, when it comes to the way in which peoples of certain nations and people of certain cultures and people of certain faiths are to which they are referred. And that, of course, distances us and takes, I think personally, it destroys any concept of our having a moral superiority. But I've never liked the idea that America's sort of superior morally. I think that America is a wonderful country with extraordinary principles, but too often, in my view, we fail to live up to those principles. And I think today we're seeing the result of stooping below what is clearly the right, or I shouldn't say that, what is clearly the principled position in order to give voice and now give force to fear and antipathy toward others. I think that demeans us all.
So, Mike, for those who want to help affect positive change or perhaps help block what they view as negative change, reaching out to congressional representatives, in your experience, is that a successful approach and one that people should continue to pursue?
I think it's absolutely urgently important. We have today people who are doing exactly the opposite of what they said they would do when they got elected or when they held that office. That, it seems to me, they need to be taken to task for. And I think there are those out there, some of them sort of going along, if you will, because they feel they must, but they're not really representing their constituents, and that's their job. So I think that contacting one's member of Congress, Senate, whatever, City Hall, to let people know, let them know how you feel is one very important thing to do. But the other is to reach out to your neighbors and your friends and your family and people you don't know, probably more to the point, particularly if those people are members of groups that are targeted or feel at this point that they're being targeted, and extend a hand of friendship and say, I'm not in agreement with the things that are being done or said. I want you to know that, and if there's a way I can be helpful, I'm anxious to do that. I think what we're seeing is some people in this country are making statements and, in some cases, designing policies that are creating, whether they intend it or not, creating the impression that we, as a nation that is predominantly Christian, are not only derisive of nations that are of another faith, but at war with them. And that is really utter disaster.
Sage advice from our friend Mike Farrell here on Downtown. Mike, I did want to also ask you about the loss of a dear colleague and friend of yours, William Christopher, who passed away recently. What can you tell us about William Christopher as a person and your experiences in working with him on MASH?
Bill was a dear friend. You know, it's become sort of a cliche to say that when we worked together for all those years, we became a family. But in this case, it's technically and in every sense of the word true. Bill and I were very close for all the years, Bill and Barbara and my wife and I and the other members of the crew whenever they were around. We were all getting together and enjoying ourselves and in remembering the old days and just having the kind of relationship one wants to have with a family member. And I knew he was sick. We knew he was sick for some time, but he was doing very well. Shelley and I, my wife and I, took them out to dinner, Barbara and Bill, and saw them even when he was going through chemo, which one expects to be pretty hard on the system. He was in good spirits and really was one of those people who seemed to somehow prevail over the ravages of this chemotherapy going through your system. And then he went into remission, and everybody was very excited. And as sometimes happens, there was a turn, and I got word from Barbara that suddenly he was deeply affected by the disease and went to see him, and it got worse and worse very quickly. I was one of the last of his friends to see him before he passed, and It was devastating in a number of ways. When you lose a loved one, and Bill was absolutely deeply loved, it hurts in a way that, as I'm sure you and some of your audience knows from experience, it hurts in a way that is kind of even hard to describe. But in this case, because he was such a warm, such a sweet, such a good man, and seemed to be doing so well until suddenly he was taken. It was particularly hard. Bill and Barbara, when I first got to know them, their kids were very young. They adopted two boys, John, one of whom is now being very helpful to his mother. Ned, the other son, is autistic, as some people who have read Bill's book know that. The trials and tribulations of learning about autism and raising a child with autism carries with it certain real challenges. And they went through a program in out of Philadelphia. They were commuting to Philadelphia periodically to meet with the people who had designed this program for children with autism. And it involved a number of things. Bill worked with Ned with flashcards. He would bring him on the set. He would work with him with flashcards and would work with him with exercises. And one of the things, and I will never forget this, one of the things that this institute urged people to do was to do through with your child a progressive series of physical exercises, creeping and then crawling and then walking and then running. And Ned was to do that for X number of yards, for X number of time, minutes each day. And Bill did it right beside him every time he had to do it. And I was so deeply moved by seeing this man give this to his son and provide for his son the kind of love and support that a lot of people just would never have thought of doing. So I have to tell you, it stirs me emotionally just to tell that story again. But every time I think of it, it encapsulates Bill in a way that I think is perfect.
That's wonderful. Every time we mention that you're coming on the show, people reach out to us and have questions. And one we often get is people want to know if you had a favorite episode. Now, you wrote and directed a number of episodes as well. Is there an episode of MASH, Mike, that you're proudest of?
Oh, gee, that's a tough one to answer, Rich. I'm so proud to have been part of that show. So I feel like the luckiest actor in the world. I always have. pride is a tough one. I was thrilled to be able to write and have the shows I wrote aired and to be able to direct some of the shows. The show that is my favorite, I can't say I don't take personal pride in it, except for the fact that I was, again, part of it, was the original, what we called The Interview, one that we shot it in black and white. It was presented as a documentary film, kind of based on the Edward R. Murrow, You Are There series he did during the war, not the Korean War, but the World War II. And they did it. We did it with Cleet Roberts, who was a real newsman. And the producers and the writers came to us with a series of questions and asked us into a tape recorder to respond to the questions in character, which they then translated to the script. So in effect, we each wrote our own scripts for that particular episode. And some of the, and of course they enhanced them and wrote some of the things that they wanted to include. But for me, that show captures the essence of MASH better and more importantly than any other.
And before we let you go, I happened to see this the other day. I was reading something else, and I came upon this little nugget, and I didn't know it. You appeared in an episode of The Monkees.
That's right. When I was starting out, you get an opportunity to work in a show, and you grab it because you need the experience, you need the money, you need to build up your record, the thing that you tell people what you've been able to do. And there were a number of episodes of shows I did where I had, you know, one line or two lines or sort of a he went that away kind of thing. And I've forgotten what I actually said on The Monkees. I think I played an FBI agent who was trying to hound them for some reason. But it was one of the early jobs I had, and I was thrilled to have it and grateful for it and put it right there on my resume.
Mike Farrell, it's always a treat for us. Thank you so much, as always, for making time for us, and thanks for your incredible, thoughtful reminiscence of William Christopher and great ideas for all of us in this strange new world we're in.
Thank you, Rich. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Mike Farrell joining us here on Downtown.